And thanks for joining us. I'm Frank Sesno of the George Washington University and host of Planet Forward, sitting in for Diane Rehm today. Diane is on a cruise with public radio listeners. Lo that we were all with her. The White House says the stimulus funds saved or created at least 650,000 jobs and helped in large measure boost GDP for the first time in a year. After 6 months of negotiation, House leaders announced their version of a health care bill. Joining me to discuss these and other top news stories, Chris Saluzza, he's author of The Fix on WashingtonPost.com, Cheryl Gay Stolberg, White House correspondent for The New York Times, and Dante Cini, he's director of the Christian Science Monitor's Patchwork Nation blog. Good day to all of you.
Hello.
Good morning.
Hello.
It's been quite a week, and I'm not quite sure where to start, but maybe I'm going to grab the Washington Post here that's on the table and look at a big headline they've got that says, Dozens in Congress Under Ethics Inquiry. What's going on, Cheryl?
Well, what's going on is an ethics House ethics staffer inadvertently posted a document on a publicly accessible website that listed dozens of names of lawmakers who are being investigated for a variety of alleged misdeeds involving payments to defense contractors and a whole host of issues. And this is obviously a problem. There are a lot of Democrats on this list. And where I see this as a huge problem, even if these Democrats aren't found guilty of anything, Democrats came in talking about corruption and cleaning things up in Washington. So now to have this whole roster of names like John Murtha and Marcy Kaptur and Jim Moran of Virginia on this list as suspected of committing ethics violations is very problematic.
Chris Saluzza's second story part of this, 7 on defense panel scrutinized, separate probes focus on ties to lobbying a firm founded by a Hill aide.
This is the Appropriations Committee charged with doling out the money, vast sums of federal government money to various companies and organizations and industries around the country is ripe for corruption in that someone gives a member who is on this committee money, they are able potentially to turn around and give a company $2.5 million. Let's just throw a number, $2.5 million in federal money. Well, for a small company trying to make its way, that's a significant piece. One person who the Post and my colleagues have written about this earlier this week, Pete Visklosky from Indiana, a Democrat from Indiana, in a very tenuous situation to my mind, on this committee, essentially helping to fund a company that no one had really ever heard of before. These are the same kind of things that John Murtha, as Cheryl mentioned, is potentially in trouble for. You know, anytime you get vast sums of federal government money with a small number of members of Congress able to dole that money out, it can be a recipe for problems.
I think it's something like bees and honey, right? Dante, how big a deal is this and where does it go?
Well, I mean, the big deal, I think, is that it's it's been leaked and we're all talking about it now. I mean, there's two ways of looking at this. In some ways, it's very unfair to the members to have their names out there when this is just an inquiry and it hasn't gone anywhere yet. The other way of looking at it is it's a real shame that this is out there now because these people didn't know that they were being investigated.
This is sort of the equivalent of the grand jury phase. I mean, this is supposed to be happening
and
in a quiet place.
Dante is right. I mean, the one thing that's hard here is this is now a guilty until you're proven innocent for all of these members. But the Ethics Committee, and this is noted in the story, but of course we won't focus on it as much. The Ethics Committee does do many inquiries in which they decide, no, nothing wrong has been done here, but we wanted to look into it. So it's possible that many of these people will wind up in that phase. Unfortunately, now the names have been named. And that's troublesome from a political perspective.
Well, and the other thing is, remember the fact that the vast majority of them are innocent. It's completely possible. But, you know, they know the investigation's going on now, which is going to alter the investigation.
And we should add that this comes on the heels of a lot of publicity about the ethics investigation into Charlie Rangel, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, a very prominent and longtime Democrat. The House Ethics Committee yesterday did publicly announce, separate and apart from this unauthorized disclosure, that it is beginning full investigations into two House members, both Democrats from California, Maxine Waters and Laura Richardson. So now we've got at least the committee publicly acknowledging three very prominent Democrats being investigated, plus this whole host of names on this unauthorized
list. And certainly not helpful as the Congress is grappling with really low public approval ratings and really high demands from the White House and their own leadership to do things like, health care reform, energy.
You know, Frank, just really quickly, to your point, the NBC Wall Street Journal poll done earlier this week, congressional approval 24%. Right. And even more stunning than that, the number of people who trust the federal government to do the right thing, 24%. Less than one in four people trust the federal government to do the right thing. Having 30-plus members' names on an ethics committee investigation that's going to get a lot of attention isn't going to help that number.
Even the media have higher numbers than that.
These car
that's
salesmen.
Saying something.
Let's turn to the economy, because this is something that has really moved substantially this week as well, at least in some areas, but hardly a clear picture. We heard yesterday GDP was up 3.5% for the third quarter, more than expected. Stock market, Dow went up almost 200 points. Then today we hear consumer spending is down. Mm. How does this get read?
Well, it's going to be muddy for a while. I mean, it's nice to look at these numbers, 3.5% in the quarter, and say, hey, we're on our way out. This is terrific. But you know, it's one quarter. There's been a lot of government spending that has gone on. There's been the Cash for Clunkers program, all these things that are kind of generated to get the economy moving again. So eventually, you see some bump up. But what also happens is that money stops flowing after a while, and that's, I think, ultimately why consumer spending is dropping. And the housing market's a mess.
And Chris, on consumer spending, as we know, this is 2/3 of the economy. So you can talk all you want about government stimulus programs, but it's really the consumers in the marketplace that bring an economy back.
So much of it's a mentality, I think, Frank. It's easy to point to numbers. I mean, frankly, I think very few people know what the GDP is. They say, 3.5%, it went up. That must be good. But the truth of the matter is, if people aren't going out and buying new televisions and buying new cars and buying things like that, the economy is not going to feel like it's recovering. And in many ways, and obviously I see it given my beat from a political perspective, the perception of where the economy is matters almost as much as the reality as we head into 2010. If people feel uneasy, then therefore the economy is not in great shape, even if you can point to numbers that suggest it is improving.
And Sheryl Stolberg, a very careful calibration yesterday from the White House and beyond as these numbers were coming out to try to mold the politics and opinion.
Right. And I think very important, couple numbers that are important that we have to remember. First of all, the jobless rate, close to 10%. Okay. Very, very important. The administration will announce today that it believes the stimulus package helped create 650,000 new jobs. However, every month we've got about 500,000 people right now applying for unemployment benefits. So that's important. The other thing that's important is that we saw housing sales fall. And we know that the tax credit for first-time home buyers that the administration put into effect in order to boost the housing market is about to expire. A big question is, what happens when government starts to pull back on all of these things that it's done to support the economy? Well, then where are we?
You know, yesterday on this program, we had the Secretary of Labor, and one of the questions was, is this recovery, if you can call one quarter of it, sustainable, Dante?
That's what we're going to have to find out, right, over the coming months. I think to what Sheryl was just saying, I mean, with this project, I'm regularly calling these people all around the country and emailing them and asking what's going on. And I emailed them just yesterday and said, hey, 3.5%, how does it look where you are? And I've gotten back a string of emails that's just, it's great and it's wonderful to see the Dow going up. But until jobs come back, we don't feel – I mean, we're struggling. This doesn't feel real to us at all.
And as much as the administration can make a case that things would have been worse without the stimulus package,
right,
the fact is that to many ordinary Americans, things still feel pretty bad.
I spoke with a friend of mine who is a home builder and who has not sold a home in over a year and a half. He's a relatively small business, just yesterday. And I said, do you see any signs of life? He's in New England. Do you see any signs of life in the new home market in which you operate? And he says he's just not seeing anything. Are we hearing that? Are you hearing that from around the country?
I mean, the really interesting thing about home sales is last week the number was there was a big increase in existing home sales, about 10%. And the fact of the matter is, look, there's just a lot of stock out there. I mean, there are a lot of foreclosures. There are a lot of homes for sale right now. So it's the housing market, before it comes back, we've got to work through a lot of stuff that's basically emptying out. It's going to take a while.
Home sales are down 7.8% year over year from their peak residential boom times back in 2005. From that point, they're down 71%.
Yeah, it's bad.
Well, I think going into next year's midterm elections, we will see all of this. The two topics that we've just discussed, both the economy and this ethics, these ethics inquiries, really front and center. And this will, both of these things could be a real problem for the Democrats.
All right, so Chris DeLuzzo, let's play devil's advocate for a moment here and say maybe the sky isn't falling. The 3.5% increase in GDP maybe is a good thing. Throw this into the mix. General Motors executives said this week that October would actually be the company's third consecutive month of market share gains, proof, they say, that consumers are returning to their showrooms.
You know, I think Dante used the word muddled, and I think that's the exact right word to use, which is for every negative predictor or negative piece of data that you can point to, you can point to a GM, you can point to the GDP. But of course, you can, as Cheryl mentioned, you can point to unemployment, 9.8%, probably going to go into double digits. That I think, is the problem. There's not a clear yes or no. The line is not moving in one clear direction. And I think, again, to return to the way in which people perceive how the economy is very different in some ways than the numbers that are out there. People are still very uneasy. And look at any poll, you're talking about 40 to 50% of people saying by far it's the most important issue facing the country. People are divided over whether the government has done too much, the government has done enough, the government has done not enough. So I think people don't know how to feel, but their baseline feeling is nervousness and anxiety, and that's good for elections because it means a lot of tension.
Quickly, Dante.
And I will say this. Muddled, as bad as muddled is better than free fall, which is where we were 9 months ago.
Okay, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show, our conversation on the Friday News Roundup, talking about the economy and much more. Take a quick break. We'll take your calls and questions. Back right after this. Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane on this Friday News Roundup. Our guest today, Chris DeLuzzo, the author of The Fix on the WashingtonPost.com, Cheryl Gay Stolberg, White House correspondent for The New York Times, and Dante Cini, director of the Christian Science Monitor's Patchwork Nation blog. Gotta do this. Email from a listener who has been listening to our conversation, writing in, congressional ethics. What an oxymoron. That's all they wrote.
That's all that needs to be said.
It's true. That's right.
Were you surprised to see this story?
I was surprised, actually. I was surprised only probably in the way that a lot of people were surprised, which is, oh, my God, somebody put this document on a publicly accessible website and everybody could look at it. It's one of those it was one of those things that journalists call gifts.
It's digital politics.
Right.
Before we leave the economy and what we can expect ahead, Cheryl, since you're at the White House and covering White House politics, how is the president playing this? Because his words seem carefully chosen.
The words that we have heard all year from the president are glimmers of hope. And I think that is basically how the president is playing this. He certainly doesn't want to overplay the GDP numbers or the positive signs when he knows that many Americans are hurting. Next week, he'll travel to Madison, Wisconsin. I'm told it's sort of a trip to the heartland to talk about these issues. And I expect that we will get the same message from him that we've had all along, which is, I know it's tough out there. I know we have a long way to go. But my administration has done things that have made the situation better.
If you have questions for our panel, want to join the Friday News Roundup discussion, you can call us at 1-800-433-8850. That's 1-800-433-8850, or email us at drshow@wamu.org. Dante, how much is the government stimulus package responsible for these glimmers of hope?
That's a really good question. It's obviously responsible for creating or saving 650,000 jobs, right?
So they say.
Those are the numbers that are coming out. This project I do, we deal with a lot of numbers, and I love numbers. Everybody loves numbers because numbers don't lie, right? They're very honest. But, you know, there just aren't good numbers for a lot of things. And when you go to recovery.gov and you start looking around at the jobs, because they said, like, well, this stimulus saved this many jobs here. This stimulus saved this many jobs here. You know, it's like you click on something and it'll say, this amount of money saved 0.25 jobs. This amount of money saved 0.08 jobs here. Or this amount of money saved 5 jobs.
So what do? You go and knock on the doors and say, excuse me, did your job get saved by
stimulus? Right. It's wonderful. We all want to measure these things. I know that. I want to measure these things too, but it's extremely difficult.
Well, it leads to a question actually that I'd like to ask Dante or anybody else if you want to jump into it. And that is if any of our listeners, because the administration has talked about transparency and trying to do this, and you mentioned these numbers, if any of our listeners actually wanted to go online and try to do this for themselves, is there a way to do that?
Oh, to poke around and look at these things?
Yeah.
It's there. I mean, you can go to recovery.gov, and you can, not to be an advertisement for the administration, and you can poke around and look at these things. What does it tell you?
What's the most reliable source for this?
I think that's the most reliable source. It's very hard to aggregate this information. Context is always important in politics, Frank, and I think that the 650,000 jobs created stat, don't forget, it comes about 24 hours after an Associated Press story that said that if you poke around on recovery.gov, in fact, there are less jobs that are being created, that people are over, that it says 125 jobs were created when, in fact, 52 jobs were created. Right. That's the problem. Quantifying, when you're talking about this much spending, this widespread to small, large, and medium-sized companies, quantifying it is the problem.
Dante?
And there's also, all these things, there's also a multiplier effect that's almost impossible to figure. I save a job in Lansing, Michigan, or two jobs in Lansing, Michigan. That means those people go out and maybe they go to Burger King, or maybe then they add a shift. Is that a job? You know, and they need to hire somebody. Is that a job? I don't know.
Cheryl, there are traceable numbers to the Cash for Clunkers program and to the $8,000 tax credit for first-time homebuyers, and now discussion of extending that program that seems to be gaining some traction here. What do we expect?
I think we expect that that program, the $8,000, will certainly be extended and, in fact, maybe expanded. I saw this week that Congress was considering I don't have the particulars on it, but somehow expanding this credit to include people who've owned or who've lived in their homes for the past 5 out of 8 years.
Right, $6,500 credit, I think it is. For
right.
That.
So I think that the feeling is that that program really has helped spur the housing market and has been very important.
Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi unveiled health care legislation package yesterday. Tell us about that, what's in it and where it's going.
You know, you now have, Frank, this week we saw in the House and the Senate come up with combined bills, which is not a small feat. The ways in which Congress works is an intricate dance that is hard to describe to the average American. There are many different, several different versions of a bill. You saw Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi come out with a single bill for each side, both of which contained the very controversial idea to some of a public option, essentially a government-run program that would compete with private insurance. Now, this has become It has long been a touchstone for both parties' bases, liberals believing that this is absolutely essential that a bill have this in order to truly reform healthcare, conservatives believing this is nothing more than the latest attempt by the Obama administration to take over, to use the government to take over private insurance.
Core of the package, $894 billion or so to provide insurance to up to 36 million people.
That's right. And some important differences in the public option provisions between these two bills. In the the House, Speaker Pelosi has come up with a plan that would be a public option that would negotiate payments with hospitals and providers. This is less than the so-called robust public option, which would have tied payment rates directly to Medicare. A lot of conservative Democrats were very upset about this. They felt that doctors wouldn't participate in such a plan because Medicare rates were so low. So Speaker Pelosi kind of irked the liberal wing of her caucus by scaling back her ambitions for that kind of robust public plan. On the Senate side, the public plan is a so-called opt-out plan, basically a national plan that would allow states to opt out. And that, too, has created some consternation on the Senate side. Senator Olympia Snowe, the only Republican who voted for the health bill in the Senate Finance Committee, has said she cannot support a final bill with a public option in it. So we're going to still see a lot of wrangling. This is by no means over.
Never mind the ways by which both houses get to how they pay for this thing,
right,
whether you tax
right.
the Cadillac plan and who that ticks off, or you tax the folks who are making the $500,000 plus.
Right.
Where's that tax battle going, do you think?
I don't know. When you look, is it easier to – who's it easier to tax? Somebody who makes $1 million a year? They're calling it a millionaire's tax even though it's $500,000 that's a lot of money. Look, that is like the top, I think, 0.03% of Americans. I think ultimately, you know, that's a fairly small constituency. The Cadillac health plan approach, to me, things get a lot trickier because even if you may not be making great money, but you feel like you have really good health insurance. And I also think opening the door to taxing Cadillac plans, I think, is scarier to people than taxing.
I want to go to 20,000 feet for a minute on what's happening here in Washington with the three of you, because you watch this closely. If we're going to talk about healthcare reform, and it's going to be real reform, there are a couple of key things it needs to do, right? Protect or cover those tens of millions who aren't covered. Control costs so it doesn't bankrupt us. So I know some people who just were screaming the other day because they got their open enrollment season and they saw what's happening with this year's premiums for their healthcare, and it just goes up and up and up. That hurts businesses. Everybody's paying for that. Is what's being discussed in Washington real reform?
I cover this issue, so I'm reluctant to say no, but I think a lot of people would say no for the two reasons you outlined. The first is that there are ways that these bills could really so-called bend the cost curve, control costs that they don't. And some of these are very technical, sort of down in the weeds, things like bundling of payments to hospitals and providers and other measures that would reduce costs over the long term. And there's, frankly, a lot of concern that these bills don't go far enough in that regard. And in terms of covering all of the uninsured, these bills will not cover all the uninsured. And in fact, the president himself has raised a hot button issue over illegal immigrants. We know there are 11 million some odd illegal immigrants here in this country. They won't be covered. If they get sick, they're still going to go to emergency rooms.
And Chris, what about the things that people care about so much? A pre-existing condition, I can still get coverage. I change my job and I can take my health care with me. Portability, it's called.
Cheryl is right in that it will be a reform of some sort. The question is it enough reform, and does it reform the right things that people want? Portability, these sorts of things you're talking about, Frank. The argument I would make, the devil's advocate argument, I suppose, and I don't want to sound like a White House parrot here, but I do think there is an argument to be made when you look at attempts to change huge social programs, that incrementalism sometimes is the best approach, that you get your foot in the door, you make certainly not the changes you would like to make, but some changes, and then you are able to go back in and make broader changes.
If I could just jump in quickly, the answer is yes. These bills would, if passed, make those kinds of fundamental changes. You'd be able to keep your health insurance. There'd be an end to lifetime caps. There'd no longer be pre-existing conditions. These are things that the insurance industry has committed to, although the industry committed to doing them when it thought that they were going to get all these new customers. Now the industry is concerned that if not everybody is covered, it doesn't make economic sense for them. It's not feasible for them to make all those kinds of changes and keep premiums down at the same time.
Why is the famous Senator Joe Lieberman threatening to filibuster this?
I mean,
because he's from Connecticut.
As a Connecticut native, I will field this one. I think that Joe Lieberman, number one, I think he believes that this public option is not the way to go. Okay, so let's put that aside. But I also think Joe Lieberman likes to be the John McCain of the Democratic side. He likes to be the maverick. He likes to be the guy who says, let's not proceed too hastily here. So I do think it's a combination of – I do think he legitimately believes this, but I also think it plays into his image. I will tell you, Joe Lieberman is up for re-election in 2012. He continues to do absolutely nothing to try and make himself whole with the Democratic base in the state, which is a huge – part of the state. I mean, in Connecticut, if you're a Democrat, you start off at 48% of the vote. You only have to get to 50. He will have Ned Lamont, who beat him in a Democratic primary 6 years ago in 2006, will run again, is my guess. The question is, can Joe Lieberman put together that coalition? I will say he's not doing himself any favors at this point with the Democratic base in the way in which he's tackling this issue.
Last quick question on health care before we move on. What happens next? What's to watch?
What happens next are votes. The speaker, came out with a bill, and I suspect she's going to bring it to the floor pretty soon. She wants to get a vote. And Senator Reid on the Senate also has a bill. It'll take a lot longer in the Senate. There'll be much more debate. The House bill will pass quickly. The Senate debate, I suspect, will last about 2 weeks, and then we'll see.
Quickly, Dante.
The one thing I would say is I when I look at the bills, the thing that concerns me most is the cost containment areas of it, which I think that's where the real problem is in the U.S. healthcare industry.
I'm Frank Sesno, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show, our Friday News Roundup. If you'd like to join our conversation, please call us at 1-800-433-8850 or send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Let's go to the calls now and start with Toby. He joins us from Fairfax, Virginia. Hi, Toby. Good Friday to you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm honored. I wanted to share with your panel members and your listening audience the perspective of an individual that has no statistical or empirical substantiation whatsoever. I have six children. I'm a small business owner, as are my two oldest children. I can tell you that from our perspective, the recession started, regardless of what is statistically accurate, from our perspective as small business owners, the recession started in November of 2008. I can also tell you that from our perspective, and our perception is that the recession ended in September of 2009. We're seeing a significant turnaround in the amount of business we're capturing.
What kind of business are you in?
I own a business, a B2B marketing consulting business. My daughter and her husband own an architectural design business. And my oldest son owns an aeronautical consulting business.
And you're saying all three of these businesses are seeing an uptick in activity?
We definitely are. Beginning in September, we talk constantly. The four other children are employed. They work for various concerns in various sizes.
Okay.
And so they're less sensitive to it. The luck for them, of course, is that they were employed during the entire period. But for a small business owner, that's experiencing a lot of the problems that your panel has described, including issues associated with healthcare, I can tell you that we started seeing a very definitive uptick in September, and October has been very busy, and we expect it to continue through November.
Well, that's great. That's great, Toby. Thanks very much. Dante, you want to comment?
The project that I work on, what we do is we look at these different places all around the country and different types of place all around the country. And the great myth is that there is a U.S. economy, a single U.S. economy. It depends on where you live. So some business owners – look, I can take you out to small business owners in places around the country that are really struggling right now. And that's not to say that the caller's experience isn't real. But I'm saying that there are a lot of different realities. And because you – this is something that everybody should keep in mind. Your individual reality, whether it's good or bad, your economic reality, isn't necessarily – the national picture, and it's certainly not it's not the picture of everybody, because the national picture is a bunch of small pictures, and different places are really struggling right now. I can tell you I look at the numbers and I talk to these people. It's not a myth that people are really struggling.
So where do you think the toughest places are?
Right now, the places that are hurting mostly is small town places that we call service worker centers, and they're basically, they're struggling. There are a bunch of small businesses, service people where they're all just kind of trading money within the community. They're hurting. Their unemployment is over 10%.
And Toby's in the suburban Washington, Northern Virginia area.
Which is really insulated.
Which is maybe doing better. Where are some of the other bright spots in the nation?
The area that's doing best in the entire country right now are these agricultural areas around the Midwest. Farm country really has not been hit by this recession. The unemployment rate is 5% in those places.
I was talking to somebody from Nebraska not long ago, as a matter of fact. It's very interesting. They've had very, very modest...
It's very smooth. Now, they don't boom. They don't boom, but their unemployment rate's sitting at 5%. They're doing pretty well right now.
Chris?
I mean, I think that's... I find stuff like that unendingly fascinating because Dante is so right. It's anytime you see national polling, and I find this all the time, national polling on the public option, 57%, I'm quoting the Washington Post poll, 57% of people favor the public option, and liberals say, how is it possible that 6 in 10 favor and yet we can't get this? Because districts around this country, Bobby Bright, who represents Southern Alabama, it's not 57% in his district, and for him, that vote could mean he doesn't come back to Congress. And so you have to remember that we are dealing with a very fragmented, not every, but that national poll does not get you to why individual members of Congress either do or don't support legislation that does have a level of controversy, like the health care bill.
Cheryl, very quickly, question from a listener, an email question. When and what is the rest of the stimulus money going to be spent on?
Well, about half the stimulus money has been spent so far, and as to precisely what it's going to be spent on, I can't say, but I would think that in the next year or so, we would see the rest of the $787 billion rolled out.
You're listening to the Friday News Roundup. Coming up, more of your calls and questions for our panel. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University. By the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. By the Gruber Family Foundation to extend the breadth and depth of NPR's international coverage, and by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. Reaction to Secretary of State Clinton's remarks in Pakistan. Iran continues sending mixed messages about its nuclear program. And the president calls for a province-by-province study of Afghanistan. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today. We're talking with our panel here, Friday News Roundup, things economic, political, and beyond. Our guests are Chris Saluzza. He's with the Fix. WashingtonPost.com is where you can find it. Cheryl Gay Stolberg, White House correspondent for the New York Times. Dante Cini, director of the Christian Science Monitor's Patchwork Nation blog. An email we've gotten here comes back to, Dante, what you were saying before the break about the different kinds of economies, plural, we're seeing. And I'd like you to share this with everybody and get your comments on it. The emailer writes, whenever commentators say we're no longer in an economic freefall, I realize how out of touch those of you who deal with the masterminds of our economy are. In my neck of the woods, we're very much in free fall. Unemployment benefits have run out, and now we're even loaning money to people who've lost their jobs and homes so they have the opportunity to return to school. It says we're building to another economic disaster here.
Yeah, it's well, I think the definition in my mind, if there is such a thing, is free fall. The definition of free fall would be people in all sorts of different places feeling like that person's feeling. But what we're seeing now, I think, is some places in the country are feeling a little better about things, and that's why things are kind of muddled. But there are – look, what the emailer said there is 100% correct. There are places in the country right now where, you know, the recession, not only is it not over yet, even when everything turns around nationally, it's not going to be over for them for months.
So here's another one. My wife and I run a small video production and graphic design company in Cary, North Carolina. In the last 6 weeks, we have seen major improvements in business. Yeah. We went from virtually no work from February 1st through the end of August, and now we can barely keep up. We see it as a sign that our customers, which are other small and medium businesses, are feeling more comfortable spending money.
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of stuff we hope we're going to be able to track because we get these economic numbers every month. We get unemployment, foreclosures, and gas prices, and we kind of sort it all out. And this last month we did this, and the numbers actually improved slightly everywhere except these Mormon communities out west for odd reasons about gas prices. But the pictures are very different. Some places the unemployment rate improved every place, but some places the improvement was fractions of a percentage point. Some places a little more than that. So it's
Just quickly, I think that's why it is such a difficult political issue. Cheryl touched on this earlier for the president. You can't make a broad claim that things are starting to look better.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's the classic John McCain, the fundamentals of the economy are strong. Well, you know, maybe for a few people they are, but not for the broad swath. So he has to do two contradictory things. He has to be empathetic to those who are still struggling while also sending a message of confidence that things are going to get better to those who feel as though they're going to get better. It's a very difficult political proposition.
Back to the phones here. Paul joins us now from Guilford, Connecticut. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I have three things I'd like your comments on. The first one is an act, and Lord, I can't remember the name of it, I should, that separated the financial industry, insurance industry, and stockbrokers. And I heard Senator Dodd on Face the State about 3 weeks ago said that he wished he had not voted to repeal it. Do you people know what? I think it was passed in 1979. And for the life of me, all I can think of is Groat Weagle and their hot dogs.
I think he's pretty close. I think
they're good
glass.
Hot dogs.
Yeah.
I think it rhymes with Glass Steagall.
That's it. That's that, yes.
So,
you did it. Why shouldn't that act be reinstated? That, you know, they're talking about regulations and so on.
All right. Cheryl Gay-Stolberg.
Well, I am not an economics correspondent, so I'm not going to go into the details of that act or why it should or shouldn't be reinstated. But there is a move. The president is trying to push for a new Financial Services Regulation Act that would place controls on the financial services industry so that these complex derivative swaps that helped contribute to the current economic crisis would be regulated, and there would be a greater government control. And this is obviously a matter of some controversy. And the longer we move into a period where we could say the economy is coming back, the harder it is for the president to affect this kind of change.
Now, this gets in, of course, to what role the government should play and what the regulatory environment is going to be.
Right,
in this
and it
week.
Brings in an international picture as well, too, because you know that the president's been meeting with the G20. Countries around the world, especially Europe, want tighter regulations. The American economy has typically been kind of a Wild West, and we tend to resist that kind of government intrusion.
One of the activities that has been going on here in Washington, of course, has been discussions over the too-big-to-fail provisions and firms this week. What are the specifics of this? What have we got that we're talking about here? At the center of this is the creation of a regulatory council to take a big look at these financial markets and what the federal government should be doing with respect to these very large financial organizations. Dante?
Well, I mean, one thing it would do is it would allow the government to come in when one of these things fails and just take it over and essentially get fire management. That's a huge thing. The other thing it would allow them to do is when they do need a bailout, the money would not come from everybody because you know, a lot of these small community banks were not happy that the money that they paid into funds ended up bailing out big corporate banks. They didn't have anything to do with this.
And it's a huge reaction to what we saw over the fall campaign, but we'll say the fall of 2008 and earlier this year, in which you essentially saw the government having to step into these massive companies and bail them out. That does not sit well with the American people. The idea that, as Cheryl mentioned, the derivatives, these very complicated swaps that were going on, that these people were making millions, billions of dollars, does not sit well with the American people. So I think what the Obama administration is trying to do with too big to fail with the regulation of the financial services industry more broadly is say that we do need to regulate this better. There is a need for these large companies doing what they do, but it cannot be sort of willy-nilly they do whatever they want because we've tried that and it failed. So again, the American public would like, I think, in some ways to see these big companies really held to account. I think the White House is doing everything that they can with the recognition that the economy needs these big companies, so they can't just sort of demagogue it politically.
Right, and the bottom line is you fail, you pay, in essence. The taxpayers are fed up with these bailouts. The president knows this, and so he's trying to use this regulation to impose that kind of almost a polluter pays model.
Prospects for something major with financial reform on the horizon?
I think that I continue to believe that nothing, if you look at past history, almost no major legislation gets done in an election year. Now, I don't want to suggest that politicians are worried about doing something controversial in an election year, though, of course, we know that that's the primary reason that nothing gets done in an election year. Between healthcare reform, cap and trade. I mean, these are things that the cap and trade vote in the House, which has already happened, is already a point of huge contention for many Democratic members who are very worried about the fact that they voted for it. There's a guy named Tom Perriello who represents Southside Virginia, a Democrat, who may lose because of that vote. I can't imagine another big piece of legislation moving through that has any level of controversy. And we're getting close, in truth, to the end of the legislative year.
I'd say quickly, I think cap and trade and healthcare, those are incredibly the political landscape around them is really fraught with peril. I do think too big to fail. You are dealing with corporate contributions in an election year, though. It may be the one piece of legislation in an election year that people can come together and pass because people are angry.
To Barbara in Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, Barbara. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Well, I would like to suggest I'm a Democrat, but I'm so disgusted with both parties, and I would like to suggest that. That you can tell by how these guys vote and by what's happening in Washington by the money involved with the lobbyist. Nothing will change. You know, I've watched all these healthcare debates and meetings and markups, all that, you know, and it's so obvious who's being funded by them. Nothing's being done for the people. It's being done. It doesn't matter if it's banking. I mean, everything.
You're just fed up.
I am fed up. Absolutely fed up.
Well, the polls suggest, Barbara, you have a lot of company with this. Chris, your thoughts?
Yeah. First of all, I want to say bless you, Barbara, for watching markups of legislative bills. You are one of a very small number of people who do that in this country. Number two, to your point, Frank, NBC Wall Street Journal poll, 50% of the American public favored the creation of a third party in a recent poll. That to me is a stunningly high number. Now, whether a third party could be viable or not is an entirely different argument. So take that piece of information, take what Barbara just said, and add to this. On Tuesday, there will be a special election in upstate New York where not the Democrat, not the Republican, but in fact a conservative party candidate is considered, and to my mind, is likely to win this race. Who is fueling him? Again, not Republicans, not Democrats, independents. He's winning independent voters overwhelmingly, 60% to 25%. These are people who are not closely aligned with either party, but are, just like Barbara, fed up with the system in Washington and think it's broken, think they need different people.
Dante.
There is out there, and there has been for a while, but particularly over the last year or so as I've been going around and going to all these places and talking to people, there is such a streak of populist kind of outrage out there. The one thing I will say about it is it seems to me that it's all over the map. There's populist outrage on the left and there's populist outrage on the right. What does that end up looking like politically? I don't know.
You mentioned these elections that are upcoming, and we always look to sort of special elections, off-cycle elections, to tell us, you know, give us a broader picture. Another place that this is happening, Cheryl Gay Stolberg, is in Virginia, a very big, very prominent gubernatorial race there. President Obama has been out campaigning. President Obama has sent personal letters, but you know what I mean, to voters in Virginia saying, vote for my friend Credides, who's the Democrat.
And New Jersey also.
And New Jersey.
It's a very tight race with John Corzine, the incumbent governor.
How much of this is going to be some kind of referendum is too strong a word, but you know what I mean, on the Obama presidency?
Whether it is a referendum or it isn't, the public will perceive it as one. If there are two Democratic losses in these states, I think it's a problem. People will say it's a bellwether, it's the canary in the coal mine. We're already hearing Republicans talk gleefully about the prospect of picking up 30 seats in the House in the 2010 midterms. We know that historically, the situation is stacked against the Democrats because the party in power tends to lose seats in a midterm election. So I do think that what happens in these races will be a very important signal. And I think maybe Chris will know better, but the best the White House can hope for, I think, at this point is maybe a mix. A win and a loss.
Cheryl,
probably a win in Virginia. I mean, a win in New Jersey for the Democrat and a loss in Virginia, but I don't like to bet.
Now, Cheryl is exactly right. I think in Virginia you're dealing with how much is Credides, the Democrat, going to lose by, and how much damage does that do down ballot? There's a lieutenant governor's race. There's an attorney general's race. Also, all the House of Delegates seats are up. At the moment, it looks to me like you're looking at a Republican whitewash, that Credides is going to lose by either high single digits or low double digits.
He's down by about 10%.
He's down by 10 to 15 yeah, in most polls. That's a big problem. If they can get a split, if John Corzine can win, and that's a big if still, I think they will be able to paint it as there's no obvious signal here. Remember, we're always in politics, you're always haunted by what's come before. Remember, in 1993, we saw Christy Todd Whitman elected in New Jersey and George Allen elected in Virginia. At the time, people said, is it a bellwether, is it a referendum or not? Well, 1994 came along. So I think if you see a sweep, and if the Conservative Party candidate does win in New York's 23rd district, that special election I mentioned earlier, you'll have the conservative wing of the party win a district in New York, and you'll have two Republican wins in two big states, including a blue state in New Jersey. And I think you will see Democrats get very nervous that we're looking at another 1994.
You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call, 1-800-433-8850 in our remaining minutes. And to the phones now, and Steve joins us from Illinois. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Thanks for calling.
Good. Just a suggestion that I hear from people from both sides of the aisle. I'm a conservative Republican from Illinois. But regardless, we're talking about things that legislation isn't going to get passed because it's an election year. And regardless of which side of the issues you fall on, term limits. You hear people all over the nation in the heartland that term limits, along with tort reform, would solve a lot of these problems. Yet you've got the Fox watching the hen house, and I doubt that's ever going to get passed anytime soon. But I think so, that's something that we need to push to try to get changed at some point in the future, and that fixes a lot of the ills in our country. The government's just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I'm not sure that's good in the long term.
And you think term limits might help? Steve's comment.
You know, term limits is a fascinating thing. I'm skeptical of its political power, and I'll give you an example. We were just talking about the 94 tidal wave election. In that election, the Speaker of the House, Tom Foley, was defeated from Washington State. He was defeated by a guy named George Nethercutt, a Republican who ran on, I'm a citizen legislator, I won't serve more than X number of terms. Well, George Nethercutt came to Congress, got comfortable being in Congress. He breaks his term limits pledge. He is the poster boy for term limits. What happens? He gets reelected.
I also think that term limits, look, people have different feelings about this. My feeling about term limits is if you think the foxes are guarding the hen house now, if you really do have people turning in and out of Congress all the time, it's not as though the institutional knowledge is going away. It's going to go away. It's the staffers are going to run the show even more.
Cheryl, look ahead for us in the week coming, because we've been talking a lot about what's been the week past with the health care legislation moving forward, with the economy and the president's schedule being what it is. What starts to move here?
I think we'll probably see a health care vote in the House. I would not be surprised if we saw one next week. It hasn't been announced yet, but it's just my gut feeling. I think we may well see debate begin if the Congressional Budget Office can come up with a score, a price tag for the Senate legislation. I think we could well see debate begin there. I think we'll certainly see the debate over the economy move. Another issue that we haven't talked about is the flu vaccine shortage. And I think a lot of Americans, and certainly here in Washington, there's a lot of concern about this swine flu.
Political peril as well as health peril.
Exactly. 46 states, the CDC says the outbreak is widespread. We know that we were supposed to have initially 120 million doses of this vaccine at the end of the month. Then that was downgraded to 40 million. Now we're at the end of the month. We only have 23 million, the health secretary said yesterday. People are scrambling for it. There are lines around the country at clinics, and that's going to be a big issue, too.
Quickly, Chris, how perilous is this?
Oh, it's extremely perilous because, remember, the president was elected on the fact that he would do the basics of government right after Hurricane Katrina. If that looks like it's not happening, and H1N1 vaccines is certainly an example of that, it undermines a piece of his presidency.
To our panel, Chris Saluzza, Cheryl Gay Stolberg, Dante Cini, thank you very much for this Friday News Roundup. You've been listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno. Have a great day.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.